This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 15th, 2008. In Washington, D.C., I'm Leon Caldwell. A video of a detainee interrogation at Guantanamo Bay has been released. A House panel questions the U.S.'s militarization of Africa, and U.S. war resistors may see refuge in Canada. Those stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testified before the Senate Banking Committee today on the nation's failing economy. His testimony comes just after the Labor Department released new statistics showing that wholesale inflation is at its highest rate in 27 years. The Producer Price Index, or PPI, showed that prices for unleaded gasoline rose 9% in June, while the price of fresh and dry vegetables shot up nearly 15%. The Fed chairman's semi-annual report comes as Congress mulls a rescue package for mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama today laid out his plans for the Iraq War. In a policy speech, Obama said that he would pursue what he called a tough, smart, and principled national security strategy.
I will focus the strategy on five goals essential to making America safer. Ending the war in Iraq responsibly. Finishing the fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Securing all nuclear weapons and materials from terrorists and rogue states. Achieving true energy security. And rebuilding our alliances to meet the challenges of the 21st century.
Obama went on to say that in his first day in office, military commanders in Iraq will receive a new mission to end the war.
Let me be clear. We must be as careful getting out of Iraq as we were careless getting in. We can safely redeploy our combat brigades at a pace that would remove them in 16 months. That would be the summer of 2010, 1 year after Iraqi security forces will be prepared to stand up, 2 years from now, and more than 7 years after the war began.
The presumptive Democratic nominee did, however, say he plans to keep a residual force in Iraq to carry out specific missions and to train and support the Iraqi security forces. Israel's cabinet approved a prisoner exchange deal with Lebanon today, in which five Hezbollah guerrillas will be exchanged for two Israeli soldiers captured in a cross-border raid that sparked a 34-day war in Lebanon in 2006. Jackson Allers has more from Beirut.
The exchange includes the bodies of 199 Hezbollah and Palestinian fighters and is expected to be led by the Red Cross at the Lebanese-Israeli border. The fate of the two Israeli soldiers captured in July 2006 is unknown, but at least one of the soldiers is believed to be dead. Israel will receive the soldiers and upon identifying them will release five Hezbollah fighters including Samir Kuntar, convicted by an Israeli court in 1979 of killing an Israeli civilian, his four-year-old daughter, and an Israeli policeman during a military raid. The prisoner exchange is being hailed as a test of the new Lebanese government that will receive the five Hezbollah prisoners. Lebanon just completed forming a national unity government this week after 18 months of political deadlock. Sources told FSRN that the five prisoners will be flown back to Rafik Hariri International Airport to be welcomed by the Lebanese state. From Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Belgian Prime Minister Yves Leterme handed in his resignation today after his government failed to push through a package of political reforms. Belgium is divided between the Dutch-speaking region of Flanders in the north and French-speaking Wallonia in the south. The Belgian king did not formally accept Leterme's resignation, so the prime minister must continue in at least a caretaker capacity for the time being. The contentious issue in the political reforms was that of increased regional self-rule. Some nationalist politicians from the Dutch-speaking region have advocated splitting from Wallonia, where incomes are lower and unemployment is high. Leterme came to power in March with the support of parties from both regions after a 9-month-long political crisis in which no one was at the helm of the Belgian government. Labor conflicts in Peru's mining sector have come to a head just days after the end of a nationwide general strike. Peruvian workers at a Chinese-owned iron mine yesterday resumed their suspended strike for higher wages. That renewed effort comes on the heels of police violence against striking gold miners over the weekend. One worker was killed and six others injured when police opened fire on the striking contract workers. Alfredo Cuadros has this report.
More than 3,000 miners were on day 13 of a strike against Peruvian gold mining company Retamas when police opened fire. 23-year-old Miguel Yupanku was killed and five others were injured. One of the injured is in a coma, with a bullet lodged in his head. The striking miners were demanding that the company hire them as formal employees. More than three-quarters of the miners at Retamas are hired as contract labor, a practice that allows that company to avoid paying employees an 8% profit share required by law. Labor conflicts in Peru's mining sector have accompanied a sharp increase in mineral exports over the past 5 years. Last year alone, Retamas Mining increased its exports by 36%, while only raising wages by a small margin. After Saturday's deadly incident, Prime Minister Jorge del Castillo promised that the government will force the mining company to pay the profit share owed to the workers. Reading for Alfredo Cuadros in Lima, I'm Antonio Ortiz.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Investigations continue on Capitol Hill into the treatment of detainees. A House panel held another in a series of hearings on the Bush administration's use of harsh interrogation tactics, techniques many label torture. After failing to appear at previous hearings, Douglas Faith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, who allegedly helped shape or knew about the interrogations, was the main witness. He testified to the humane treatment of prisoners. But in response to questions about whether the techniques used by the Bush administration would be allowed under the Geneva Conventions, he admitted that inhumane techniques could have been used.
It depends how they are. It depends how they're used. They could be used in a way that violated the convention. They could be used in a way that's consistent with the convention.
Committee members probed about the interrogation methods introduced under then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. They asked about hooding and stripping of prisoners, 20-hour interrogations, threatening the detainee with death, threatening the detainee's family members, exposure to cold, poking and grabbing, and simulating suffocation. Representative John Conyers is top Democrat of the committee.
So here's the problem the Committee on the Constitution finds itself engaged in this morning. We can't investigate those who did the waterboarding because they had legal approval. We can't investigate those who gave the approvals because our intelligence agents relied on them for advice. It's a perfect circle that leads us round and round and round and nowhere closer to the truth.
Meanwhile, a videotape of a Guantanamo interrogation has been released. Lawyers for one of the youngest detainees, Canadian Omar Cotter, released 10 minutes of 7 hours of footage from 2003. Cotter was just 16 at the time. He's accused of throwing a grenade at a U.S. soldier.
He said, "I can't move my arms. I requested medic for a long time. He doesn't know anything about it."
Well, I mean, they look like they're healing well to me. You know, I'm not a doctor, but I think you're getting good medical care.
No, I'm not. You're not here.
Cotter's attorney released the video, hoping it will help his case. Cotter is still detained. He's expected to appear before a military tribunal in the fall. Joining us to talk about this case is Pardis Cabriai, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Pardis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Pardis, are you surprised by what you see in this tape, Cotter's pleading and crying, and also the interrogator's response and role in this video?
I'm not surprised. This is very much in line with what we've heard from our own clients who are at Guantanamo and the conditions we've seen them in. But I do think it is incredibly important and a good thing that it's finally, that, you know, this kind of information and visual information is now available to the public. I think it offers a glimpse into what our clients and the other prisoners at Guantanamo have been subjected to, which is a system that is really meant to break people down physically and emotionally and psychologically. And in that context, the U.S. military and foreign interrogators have been extracting information that has been used to prosecute prisoners at Guantanamo.
And you said this resembles what some of your clients are telling you. Can you specify and can you expand on that a bit?
Just in terms of, interrogations, we have a client, for example, who has been subjected to hundreds of interrogation sessions by an individual who, I mean, what we saw actually in the Cotter video was not quite as graphic or abusive as what we've heard from our clients, but interrogators who have spent hours in interrogations with our clients, yelling at them, verbally assaulting them, physically beating them, just a lot, you know, extreme physical and verbal and emotional abuse. In terms of conditions, Cotter, prior to this interrogation, we know that he was kind of softened up by U.S. military authorities so that he would be sort of prepped and ready for the Canadians. And he was subjected to something called a frequent flyer program, which is essentially moving prisoners from cell to cell for, you know, every three hours so that they, to prevent them from uninterrupted sleep. And Cotter was also held in isolation for a few weeks before this interrogation, and we know the same thing to be true for our own clients in terms of this kind of frequent flyer program. Many of them have been subjected to that, sleep deprivation, you know, held in solitary, and again, ways of just breaking people so that they are in, you know, willing to cooperate and say essentially what interrogators want them to say, and it's that information, again, that's being used to justify their detention.
In this Cotter tape, it was a Canadian intelligence officer who was doing the interrogations. What is Canada's role here? Are they doing interrogations alongside the U.S. at Guantanamo?
Well, I mean, a number of foreign governments have sent delegations to Guantanamo to either get their own information and find out who's at Guantanamo or perhaps to get information that the U.S. Can use. Canada's role here, I'm not exactly sure what the purpose of this interrogation was, but I think it highlights that there is a certain cooperation going on between the United States and foreign governments, and this kind of cooperation and you know, collaboration has occurred in different ways. In some ways, it's using foreign interrogators or sharing information between the U.S. and foreign governments. In other ways, we've heard of foreign governments allowing the use of airspace, for example, foreign governments handing over prisoners to U.S. authorities who then ship them to Guantanamo, foreign governments that allow the use of their prisons as holding pens or places where prisoners can be interrogated either by, you know, U.S. officials or by foreign officials who then share that information. So what's happening at Guantanamo is primarily the responsibility of the United States, and it's been orchestrated by the United States, but it's very important, and I think this video is a glimpse into the role that other governments have played in facilitating what's happening there.
Pardis, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
That was Pardis Cabrillai, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can hear us online at www.fsrn.org. I'm Leanne Caldwell. Stay with us. The Department of Defense has recently become the dominant face of the U.S. abroad, minimizing the role of the diplomatically focused State Department. Nowhere is that more apparent than in Africa. As Tanya Snyder reports from Washington, the U.S.'s creation of Africa Command, or AFRICOM, proves that the military is continuing to increase its reach.
Government officials envisioned AFRICOM as an interagency program, but only 1% of its staff is from any agency besides the Department of Defense. And this Defense Department dominance concerns some. At a congressional hearing Tuesday, Oversight Committee Chair John Tierney said the U.S. needs to use smart power, not hard power.
Leading with the military and making everything military dominant may not be the way to approach our situation here, and that we have to use a sort of smart power. But I think, you know, it looks to us like we're leading, you know, with the military here. It looks like we're putting an outpost in Africa.
The military budget in Africa is 5 to 7 times the size of USAID's budget to do similar work. NUSAID has seen its Africa program steadily underfunded and understaffed over the last 8 years. In addition to classic military operations, AFRICOM staff insist that it is heading up humanitarian and diplomatic efforts, which they say are military operations, and that they all belong under the umbrella of the Pentagon. Roxanne Lawson of the TransAfrica Forum disagrees.
A military force can't deliver soft power. It doesn't do that. It's hard power by definition.
AFRICOM officials say they are not looking for large permanent bases on the continent, and it's having a hard enough time figuring out where to establish its headquarters. Four African countries have publicly refused to let them in, and only one has invited them. Meanwhile, their entire staff is in Stuttgart, Germany. So what is the purpose of AFRICOM? Teresa Whalen, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for African Affairs, says they're there to build security cooperation and counterterrorism skills and to support U.S. government programs. While she acknowledges concerns about their motives, she says they're all unfounded.
Some believe that we are establishing U.S. AFRICOM solely to fight terrorism or to secure oil resources or to discourage China. Some have raised the concern that U.S. AFRICOM will take control of security issues that are the responsibility of the Africans themselves. Finally, there are fears that U.S. AFRICOM represents a militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa, and that U.S. AFRICOM will somehow become the lead U.S. government interlocutor with Africa. These are misperceptions.
Lauren Plock, African Affairs Analyst for the U.S. Congressional Research Service, said there's a perception in Africa that this is a neo-colonial effort.
Colonial memories are still fresh in a lot of the continent, and the idea of a U.S. troop presence is very concerning for a lot of Africans.
Ambassador Mary Yates, who headed U.S. embassies in Ghana and Burundi and now works for AFRICOM, says this is a different kind of military effort.
There has been a big change in the attitude to the Africans because we've been listening to them.
Major General Michael Snodgrass, AFRICOM's chief of staff, says State Department personnel still trumps the military.
Nothing happens in those countries without the ambassador saying they want to do it. Unless they say go, nothing happens.
But Democrat Betty McCollum of Minnesota says diplomats seem to be losing out to military personnel.
When you say AFRICOM's ahead and everybody falls in underneath it, my question then becomes, what role does an ambassador have in a country? If there's AFRICOM, I think we have a real problem here in the way that we are starting to blend the role of the military and the role of the State Department. They should complement one another, but there should be no confusion. There should be a very bright line.
AFRICOM began initial operations last October and is set to become fully operational this October 1st. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Union organizing has always been a risky endeavor in Guatemala. During the civil war that ended in 1996, hundreds of union workers and activists disappeared or were murdered. A complaint submitted to the Guatemalan and U.S. governments last month by the AFL-CIO on behalf of five Guatemalan unions says the country could be returning to those levels of violence. The unions blame CAFTA, or the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Trevor Snapp reports from Morales, Guatemala.
During the initial debate over CAFTA, unions and leftist groups in Guatemala and the U.S. argued it would disadvantage poor workers while weakening labor rights. The economic fallout is still unclear 2 years after the agreement took effect, but reports of human rights abuses against organizing workers have dramatically increased. Rob Weiss works for the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center in Guatemala City. Since CAFTA was signed, his organization has documented 8 murders, 1 attempted murder, 2 drive-by shootings, a rape, and dozens of death threats.
Somebody might ride by and roll down the window and say, you should watch yourself and watch what you're doing at the workplace. Death threats received through your telephone or your cell phone.
The AFL-CIO complaint comes as the U.S. Congress considers a free trade agreement with Colombia, where more union leaders are killed each year than the rest of the world combined. Free trade supporters say the deal would help the country's economy and strengthen its democratic institutions, thereby lessening violence against labor activists. Free trade skeptics believe that Guatemala's experience proves otherwise. The Union of Isabel Banana Workers, known as Citrabi, is based in the lawless town of Morales in eastern Guatemala. The oldest union in the country, its members work and live on a banana plantation owned by Del Monte Fresh. Noé Ramirez, the Secretary General, is in his office preparing for a meeting. For Ramirez, violence is nothing new. In 1998, the entire leadership of the union was kidnapped and tortured when they protested against the mass firings of 900 workers. But for Ramirez, the recent violence is different. It's personal.
Bueno, el 23 de septiembre, mi hermano fue asesinado.
On the 23rd of September, my brother was assassinated at 5:45 in the morning when he left his house. He was 100 meters away when four people in masks and automatic weapons opened fire and killed him as he walked to work.
Months later, his brother's death has yet to be investigated.
When we submitted a complaint to the public ministry, they started persecuting and intimidating us.
According to Claudia Samoya, the coordinator of Human Rights Defenders of Guatemala, clandestine groups are responsible for the recent attacks. She says the paramilitary groups were created by the army and government during the country's civil war to do their dirty work. To fund their activities, the groups operated smuggling rings sanctioned by the government. The end of the war pushed them further underground.
These are all groups that never existed, but existed.
Clandestine groups are able to operate with impunity thanks to their ties to powerful political and business interests. Samoya says the divisive COFTA debate in Guatemala branded unions as the enemy.
When you look upon the relation between mafia, organized crime, and clandestine structures and the state, you have to bear in mind that all of these groups come from the state. These are not groups that infiltrate the state. It's the state that has promoted them. So after CAFTA, I think basically clandestine structures arose again.
The Guatemalan Ministry of Labor maintains there is no direct connection between the rise in violence and CAFTA. Yet one thing is clear, the U.S. government has less ability to successfully pressure Guatemala to act on labor abuses. When the Setrabi union leaders were kidnapped in 1998, the U.S. played a pivotal role in resolving the situation through trade pressure. Today, they have little room to maneuver. The AFL-CIO complaint is the first test for CAFTA's workers' rights provisions. The U.S. Department of Labor is expected to respond to the complaint in the next few months. At the Setrabi headquarters, Ramirez is trying to get members to sit down for a meeting about a recently fired worker. The threat of violence and the geopolitics of free trade is surely in the back of his mind. But for now, he still has a union to run. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Trevor Snapp, Morales, Guatemala.
A movement for autonomy in Bolivia's eastern states is threatening President Evo Morales' ambitious land reform plans. Three states voted for autonomy from the central government. They followed the lead of Santa Cruz, which opted for autonomy in May. Since then, violent altercations between government officials and landowners have escalated. Martin Markovitz reports.
Located 4 hours outside of the city of Santa Cruz, the quiet town of Cuevo has taken center stage in the fight for autonomy between ranchers and the Bolivian federal government. For 2 months, the city held a blockade denying entry to government officials whose aim is to redistribute the land to the Guarani tribe, the area's local indigenous group. Residents and landowners accuse the central government of using the Guarani tribe as an excuse to control more privately owned local land. Sonia Lodres is the mayor of Cuevo.
85% would be affected, and we told the authorities not to enter here. So we were already alerted and started organizing to resist.
The government's policy of transferring land to indigenous people has been so far unsuccessful. La Paz's original plan was to distribute 35 million acres among 2.5 million people in the next 5 years. Most of the recipients would have been the indigenous peasants who are the majority of Bolivia's population. However, most of the land slated for redistribution is in the east, where the majority of the landowners are Bolivians of European descent. According to Fabian Restivo, a high-ranking official in President Morales' delegation in Santa Cruz, the government is trying to correct previous land reform measures that have failed to give land to the indigenous population.
Since the government came into power, they have been conducting land reform. The first reform in 1952 was done very badly. The ones who benefited are the current rich landowners.
The government apparently underestimated the ranchers' resistance. In the past 5 months, ranchers started several violent altercations with government officials. In February, American rancher Ronald Larson held a government official captive for 24 hours for allegedly trespassing on his land. Government officials have also accused the ranchers of keeping the Guarani workers in slave-like conditions. Again, Fabian Restivo.
Son golpeados, violados, amenazados.
These people have been taken advantage of repeatedly. They don't have a salary, they work 20 hours a day, and they live in makeshift shacks made out of sticks. We have been trying to set up a literacy program for years.
Santa Cruz is Bolivia's richest province, but almost all of the Guarani indigenous people who work the lands live in extreme poverty. Literacy rates are extremely low. The schools that do exist in Guarani communities only go up to the eighth grade. Ranchers have defended the Guaranis' living conditions. Mario Marbere is a peanut plantation owner who has more than 100 Guarani people living and working on his land.
We live in a perfect harmony with the Guarani. They help us and I help them, and we never have a problem with them. But it is not my responsibility to take care of these people. It is the government's responsibility. I built schools and clinics, but I am just one person. The government needs to step in and do it.
Another element in this conflict is newly discovered oil and gas reserves found on many of the ranchers' lands. Under existing Bolivian law, underground oil and gas reserves are property of the federal government. However, under the proposed new constitution that President Morales has been pushing, revenues from existing energy reserves found on indigenous lands would partly go to the indigenous tribes themselves instead of the regional government. The funds would go to infrastructure and educational programs for indigenous communities. Landowners say this is an attempt by the Morales government to centralize power and use the indigenous people as a front to gain more control of these resources. But, according to Fabian Restivo, the government's intentions are for the indigenous community to have an equal say in where and how the revenue is spent so they can better their communities.
Lo que está debajo de la tierra es del Estado. Ahora, una cosa que está prevista en la nueva Constitución Política del Estado es que...
Now, the one thing that is new in the Constitution is that if there is oil on Indian-controlled land, they will get a percentage to use in their own community to create a better standard of living. And what do the landowners say? Oh, well, if you give them money, they won't know what to do with it, so it is better if we get it.
Si le damos plata, no van a saber qué hacer con la plata. Entonces mejor la plata nos la quedamos nosotros.
The autonomy movement in Bolivia's eastern states has stopped land reform for the time being and put the new constitution on hold. The eastern states have threatened to withhold their gas revenues from the Morales administration, despite the federal government's insistence that their autonomy measures are not legally binding. For FSRN, this is Martin Markovitz in Santa Cruz, Bolivia.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our program is made possible by Pacifica Radio, community radio stations, and listener supporters. You can drop us a line at comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Today's editorial team includes Christian Schwartz, Vinod Jose, Catherine Comp, Shannon Young, and Otto Bogado. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Kadopchi and Oscar Hernandez. In Washington, I'm Leanne Caldwell.